You're listening to a sermon by Janice Kreider, recorded on Sunday, December 13, 2009, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, my talk doesn't have too many jokes, so on a light note, I would like to thank Rosie for wearing pink, even though we didn't have a pink.
That's candle. Why I did.
Is that why you did it?
I wasn't sure what the candle situation was, but I just had to wear pink. Just in case.
So that worked out. All the right colors. What then should we do? The social conditions that the Jewish people experienced at the time of the birth of Jesus and of John the Baptist are described in Mary's song and in John the Baptist's father's prophecy. Mary said, "He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich empty." We hear about abuse of power, hungry people, and a resentment of the rich. And Zechariah says that we, being rescued from the hands of our enemies, might serve him without fear in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. We hear about enemies, fear, and a restriction of religious freedom. The problems of the Jewish people of that time had both an economic and a political basis. There were poor in the land. There were powerful enemies, forces that made it hard to practice righteousness. Politics, economics, and religion were not working for the common people. In Deuteronomy 15:4, the Jerusalem Bible translated as, "Let there be no poor among you." The Ten Commandments and the many lesser laws in the Old Testament were created to regulate an agricultural society and release the poorest of the poor from their debts on a regular basis. When the society was no longer agricultural, for example, during their captivity, additional interpretations of the laws had to be developed, and they promoted the giving of alms to the poor. When in verse 8, John the Baptist stated, "Do not begin to say to yourselves, 'We have Abraham as our ancestor,'" thereby justifying a religious and ethnic background as covering any guilt or responsibility related to inequities in society, John was telling his audience that this kind of reliance on religion was totally inadequate. Herman Hendricks, a theologian now in the Philippines, in his book, The Third Gospel for the Third World, states it this way: "The gist of John's message is that Israel itself no longer had the means to be a salvation community." And we might phrase it, they needed a different paradigm. Regarding John the Baptist and Jesus, we usually think of them as two separate people with separate messages and separate locations for their ministry, although we know of the strong link between them when John baptized Jesus. However, it may be helpful to think of their combined ministry in a continuum. Jesus was a disciple of John, and at least three of Jesus' disciples were disciples of John. Both men emerged in the same milieu with a similar message for all people. And they both worked, definitely, outside the religious establishment. Both were likely influenced by the Essenes. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, but that was an anti-establishment religious group that lived in the desert. Only after John was arrested and unable to teach did Jesus leave the desert and go into the villages of Galilee on a preaching tour. John's main theme was preaching a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. And Jesus did not start out preaching repentance in his early teaching. His emphasis was on the release of captives and forgiveness of sins. Now, the captives were probably people put in jail because they owed too much money. But then in Luke 5:32, with this statement, I have come to call not the righteous, but sinners to repentance, Jesus began to emphasize the concept of repentance. And he continued to emphasize it in the remaining time of his ministry, actually in a stronger way in Luke than in the other three gospel accounts. Now, Erna read all the verses in Luke that are in the lectionary today, but I couldn't cope with all those verses. So I'm just going to look at verses 11 to 13. Well, look a little bit at 10. And I was intrigued by the instructions that John the Baptist gave in verses 11 to 13 in response to the question from the people, what then should we do? Because the answers are so specific, and they give us insights into the society of the time. These verses are known as John's ethical teachings, and these verses are not in the other three Gospels. This omission in the other three Gospels caused a problem for the biblical scholars that participated in the Jesus Seminar. This project was a collaborative endeavor in the early 90s to study documents in order to determine the authenticity of all parts of the gospel accounts. The scholars that worked on this gave an authenticity score, I think that's what you would call it, of 33% to verse 11 and 27% to verses 13 and 14. And what this means is that while the scholars agreed that there's certainly a possibility that these sayings are attributed to John, they harbored doubts because the material was not part of the documents that the other three gospel writers used. Now, Luke's special interests in writing the book of both Luke and Acts were the inclusiveness of the Christian story, along with condemnation of the wealthy and exaltation of the impoverished. The verses fit in with Luke's theme. So did he make up these words in order to make a nice story? And I know when I write minutes, well, I used to write minutes for the congregation, sometimes you switch things around because it works better if you move things around so it's not exactly the way the meeting went. Now you know. So did he make up these words totally, create them out of his head? Or did he remember them because for him they were significant and memorable? Or did he have a source that the other three writers didn't have? Well, the biblical scholars don't know. We don't know either. So in light of this, should we throw up our hands and not study this passage or take it seriously? And I would say no. Perhaps the words were not John's, however they were written. Perhaps they were Jesus' words. Do they sound like something he would say? At the very least, somebody, Luke himself, or whoever wrote the extra material that the other gospel writers didn't have at hand, thought that these ethical teachings of John fit in with the good news. The content of these verses has some relevancy. So I think we're free to go on and study them and try to understand them. So verse 10 has the question from the people, what then should we do? Their question followed from John's statement to bear fruits worthy of repentance, and John's telling them that calling Abraham their father wasn't going to be enough. Note that this question in verse 10 came from the people in general, not from the Pharisees or the Sadducees or from people in the religious establishment, although it may have included them. The word repentance in the Greek moved from its early meaning of second thoughts to change of thinking to change of mind, heart, view, opinion, or purpose. Regret and remorse were often associated with it. But the people listening to John knew that bearing fruits meant more than just changing their minds and a bit of remorse. It meant actions, and they wanted to know what those actions should be. And you'll recall the same question was asked by others in the New Testament, like the rich young ruler, what should I do to be saved? And the crowd listening to Peter's first sermon in the beginning of Acts. Verse 11, whoever has two coats must share with anyone who has none, and whoever has food must do likewise. This statement appears to be straightforward, a straightforward instruction, and appears to apply not just to the super rich, but to the class of people supplied with enough of the basic needs of life that they could spare food and clothing from time to time. John's answer resembles the Jewish traditional practice of almsgiving. There's no real news here, but John must have thought that this kind of sharing was not practiced as much as it should be. What is the result of being aware who in the community has a need for food or clothing and attempting to supply it? Well, it's good news to the poor. Verse 13. Collect no more than the amount prescribed for you. This teaching was directed at the recently baptized tax collectors. John did not say, leave your profession, but that could be the end result. The tax system had many layers, and I read a couple of books about this. The upper layers were held by the Romans, but the indirect taxes, such as tolls, customs on transported goods, taxes on business transactions, inheritance, and so on, had to be collected at a local level, and local Jews, paid a fee to the Romans to collect these. Now, these local collectors, of course, were trying to make a living, so they had to collect more than the fee that they had paid. And additionally, one can understand how unclear the amounts of taxes might be in that pre-internet society. You couldn't go on the website and say, okay, it's supposed to be such and such. If the tax collector collected only the amount that he had paid to his superior, he would make no money at all, plus endure the pains of being a hated tax collector. And who would choose to have this kind of a no-paying job in a toxic environment? We have the example of Levi, who dropped his tax collecting job to follow Jesus. We also have the example of Zacchaeus, on the other hand, who didn't leave his position. What would be the result of Jewish men leaving their positions, trying to find other work, likely at a much lower pay? Or what if they followed John's teaching, not collecting extra money, and had to rely on their community for food and clothing? Well, it's good news for the Jewish community because it would improve relationships within the community. Solidarity would be increased. It could create a bit of chaos for the authorities if no one wanted to be a tax collector, and it could disrupt tax collecting for a while, but chances are that people would step forward thinking it's easy money and it wouldn't shut down the system for long. Verse 14. Do not extort money from anyone by threats or false accusation, and be satisfied with your wages. This teaching was directed to the soldiers. And again, John does not say, leave your position. These are likely Jewish men who help, in quotes, the tax collectors to convince people to pay their taxes. They might have been helping the Romans. The soldiers were probably assigned to do this, and they would be commanded to use violence, abuse, and threats, whatever they needed to do, to obtain the tax money. If they did not obey their superiors, they would be in deep trouble and end up losing their jobs, or worse, basically being persecuted for righteousness' sake. What would be the result if these Jewish soldiers did not abuse the ones being taxed, or voluntarily or non-voluntarily left their positions? Well, it's the same good news for the Jewish community that I mentioned with verse 13. It would decrease acrimony within the Jewish community. Now some concluding remarks, and I didn't know what Rosie's theme was going to be with the Advent candle, so this fits in well. As I mentioned earlier, repentance, the theme of both John the Baptist and Jesus, is often associated with regret. We think of repentance to involve serious prayer, fasting, and mourning. And indeed, John the Baptist's disciples were known to fast and pray. But perhaps that was not so much a result of their repenting, but of mourning that their leader was in prison or that he met up with a violent death. Jesus, on the other hand, was constantly enjoying dinner invitations to tax collectors' homes, where a diverse guest list included former prostitutes and sinners. Jesus was criticized by the Pharisees for taking part in these dinners. His response to them in Luke 15 was a series of parables on joy that you're familiar with. Joy the woman had in finding her last coin. Joy the shepherd had finding the one sheep out of 100. Joy the father had seeing his long-lost son appear far off down the road. Jesus was trying to say that the good news that he and John the Baptist preached was marked by celebration and joy. And this time of year we sing Joy to the World. It's the joy of being part of a caring community where there are no poor ones, people are treated fairly, and where anyone who wants to live that way is welcome to become a member. Later in the New Testament, we read accounts of these types of inclusive communities emerging in various places in the Mediterranean region. John the Baptist's hard words in answer to the question, "What then should we do?" are specific to the harsh realities of his place and time. The new communities had their own realities, and following John's instructions as literal rules, especially the ones to the tax collectors and soldiers, may not have been very appropriate. The new communities had to interpret his words of fairness and caring in light of their own environment, as we have to do today.